Hello and welcome to World Business Report from the BBC World Service. I'm Leanna Byrne. And on this edition, President Xi goes to Lima as Peru gears up for the 31st Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation Economic Leaders Meeting. That's a mouthful, but don't worry, we will explain. We hear how the wine industry is coping with climate change-induced extreme weather conditions.
Since 2019, it became apparent that we have to kind of evolve our cultivation techniques. Here, we're not talking about irrigation that will increase the yields. We're talking about irrigation that will help the plants survive.
And Jaguar is betting big on EVs and is even going so far as stopping selling new engine cars in the UK entirely. If that one has induced some range anxiety, let me know on WhatsApp or send us a voice note on 0044 330 678 3033, or you can just send us an email at any time on world.business@bbc.co.uk. But let's start with our top story. All eyes are on Lima, the capital of Peru, as the city hosts the 31st Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation Summit. It's bringing leaders from across the world to tackle big topics like climate change, sustainable energy and trade. But there's an interesting subplot here, the deepening ties between Peru and China. Here's Julio Perez Alván, chairman of Peru's Exporters Association.
This helps jobs, formal jobs, because 75% of the Peruvian economy is informal. So this helps to formalize these jobs. Other areas that we can cooperate, health areas, no, technological areas, sectors. We are trying to open more products to be sent to China. I hope in this new part of the agreement is considering this. So this will be very benefit for our country.
Julio Perez Alván there. Now we've got a friend of the program, senior Asia correspondent for Bloomberg, Rebecca Chung Wilkins, who is in Peru. Hello, Rebecca.
Thank you so much for having me, Leanna.
Oh, thanks for being on. What's it like there right now?
I have to say, the pretty heavy security presence on the ground and a lot of traffic. So this tends to happen at APEC. I've been at various ones around the world. You do tend to spend a lot of time just in cars waiting to get through various stop points and checks and stuff. But it's a really heavy showing from leaders, you know, Vietnam, Malaysia, Indonesia, New Zealand, and of course, President Xi Jinping coming in from China and Biden coming from the US. So it's a really heavy security presence, as you expect.
I've been reading that there's a really visible presence of China, just, you know, Chinese billboards and investment. How is that being perceived on the ground?
Yeah, it's really interesting. I mean, I think that's probably true of Latin America too, not just in terms of sort of billboards, but also in terms of the financial sector looking out over the financial district, you know, increasing presence of Chinese banks and so on as well. It certainly has been the sort of big story, this question of the role that Beijing and China plays in Latin America and also in other parts of, you know, so-called global South, particularly, of course, because of the proximity to the US and the history of US investment. You know, very much sort of having and being much more forward led here. Increasingly, we see countries like Peru, countries like Brazil turning to shift their focus to think about what China and the Asia Pacific can be offering them instead of the US. And it has made the US uneasy even before, you know, this incoming Trump presidency.
Yeah. How is that influencing discussions at APEC? Because I'm sure it's a big thing at the moment. Do people wondering, is there any sense of concern or even a strategic recalibration among attending nations?
Yeah, look, I think that's going to be the big question and the big elephant in the room. Trump himself not expected to attend. It's going to be Biden, of course. But, you know, this really is the big question. APEC itself, the beginning sort of origin point was the celebration of free and open trade. Now we have a US president coming in who's increasingly protectionist, who's talking about 60% tariffs on Chinese inputs, 20% tariffs on everything else. So it is a very, very different, you know, increasingly geoeconomically fractured world that people will be dealing with. And it's not just sort of countries having to deal with the tariffs themselves. It's all of the fallouts. For example, if we see really high tariffs on Chinese goods, where else are they then seeking to try and export their own goods into other markets? And that has already been a point of friction. We've had other countries historically who are quite friendly with China, kind of quite irritated exacerbated by, for example, the volume of steel that is coming in, and these claims about overcapacity coming and being echoed from other corners, not just from the US and its allies.
Well, we've got another guest on this who I think is one of the most perfect people to ask the same question to, Alfredo Thorne, former Minister of Economy and Finance of Peru. Alfredo, thank you so much for joining us.
Hello, Eliana. Thank you very much for having me on your program.
Well, same question to you. How might Donald Trump's presidential win and proposed tariffs, might they impact Peru's economic strategy? Could Peru get caught up in a deeper trade war between the US and China?
Well, I think that, in my view, this changes the rules of the game. I think if the idea was that China was going to build this port and then put some auto plants in Peru to export into the U.S., that's not going to happen. I think it's going to force us to realign our trading partners. And clearly, we would like to be, we always have liked to be in the middle. But my sense is that we'll have to take sides, in this case, much more with the U.S. than China.
I mean, China's footprint in Peru has grown. Are there any geopolitical risks that come with those investments?
Well, yes, there are. But my sense is that this approach of Peru with China has been, extrapolated very fast. Let's take the port, for instance. The port of Chancay is going to move 1.3 million containers. And only the port that is today financed by DP World, the Emirates, is going to move 3.8 million containers.
Oh, I think we've lost Alfredo. Alfredo, can you hear us?
Sorry.
You're okay there.
Yes, I can hear you.
You were talking about the port, if you want to just pick up from there.
Okay. Yes, so we're going to inaugurate 8 ports, not only the port of Chancay, and we're going to pass from moving 2.3 million containers to around 6 next year. The port of Chancay is going to account only for 1.3. All the ports are going to account for the rest. So I don't think it's only China. It's that we are having other investors. The U.S. is going to have 2 ports. And that's also going to change. The other key point is that what we export to China is mainly minerals, rocks, no? And what Peru wants to do is wants to jump into the supply chains of emerging Asia. And that's probably the main focus of these APEC meetings, of how do we link with Taiwan, with Singapore, and the other major Asian economies that are much more pro-manufacturing and that can bring value added to Peru that could be exported to the U.S. Peru today has 22 free trade agreements, and that means that we have a very diversified source of connections in terms of our trade.
Yeah, of course, any investment strategy, diversification is key, isn't it? You don't want to rely on a single trading partner. However, it does seem as if, particularly at this APEC meeting, that, you know, Peru is definitely showing its ties to China. And if China approached Peru, I would presume you've been in plenty of meetings like this about investment. If they offer more investment, it's pretty hard to say no to, right?
Well, that is true, and China is our main trading partner, but they account for like 70% of the total trade. The U.S. accounts for 16%. So we in Peru have a very balanced diversification of trade. The fact that the Chinese want to invest in Peru doesn't mean that Peru is only going to attract Chinese investment. We have a very strong presence from the U.S., from Asia, from Europe. And in general, it's very diversified. But you are right. The discussions are going to be whether Peru is going to turn into a Chinese satellite in Latin America. But my personal feeling is that that's not going to happen.
And is there always a danger that, you know, these policies can often favor foreign investments without actually adequately ensuring long-term local economic benefits?
Yes and no. But for instance, our experience with Chinese investment has not been very good. most of the conflicts that miners had with communities were in mines with Chinese investment, like La Bambas or Shogun. Whereas the investment that we have from Anglo-American, your side of the world, and then from the Australians, have been no single confrontation with the communities. So you tell me which investment would you want to have in your country, no?
Well, I don't have to answer that question, thankfully. Alfredo Tone, former Minister of Economy and Finance Peru, we really appreciate your time. And also Senior Asia, our Asia correspondent for Bloomberg, Rebecca Chung Wilkins, who is in Peru. Thank you both. Now let's turn our attention to crypto, which has been on the rally this week following Donald Trump's election win. Bitcoin surged to a record high of $90,000 on Tuesday, a 30% rise since November 5th. So why is there so much optimism that Trump's administration will be good for crypto? I have Professor Carol Alexander of the University of Sussex Business School. Hello.
Hello, Leanne.
Carol, do you know what Trump has proposed that has investors anticipating deregulation? What policies could be brought in here?
Well, there aren't any policies as such, but planning to fire Gary Gensler as head of the SEC is a big statement. Not that he's really able to. I mean, he needs to prove some sort of cause like negligence of duty or something like that. But the thing is that Gary Gensler has been a proponent of sort of regulation of crypto via litigation, you know. So there are several cases that the SEC, to the expense of its creditors, the ordinary asset managers who fund the SEC, traditional asset managers are paying to have Gary Gensler take these cases against crypto companies such as Coinbase and Binance, which has sort of stemmed the growth of crypto. But, I mean, historically, he'll probably resign. Most SEC chairs do usually step down anyway.
Well, we'll just have to see. But it's interesting, isn't it? He wasn't always a fan of crypto. I mean, people have been pulling...
No, not at all.
Exactly. People have been pulling out these old tweets from Trump's Twitter, yeah, or X now that it's called, saying that, you know, he's completely not a fan of crypto. But during the campaign, he accepted donations from crypto. He appeared, yep, at industry events. Has that really... Is that massively behind... Even just the perception of that, is that, could that be behind the rally as well?
Yeah. I mean, he wanted to get the younger male voters on board, really, and they're known to be, you know, the largest demographic drawn towards investing in Bitcoin and other crypto because they like the risk and they need something new. You know, the young men in particular seem to be delusion. I mean, you know what I mean? In today's society.
Very taken, yeah, by cryptocurrencies at the moment.
Young people. Yeah.
Exactly. I mean, if Bitcoin's rally continues, there's some projections out there saying it could get to over $99,000. I mean, how realistic do you find these projections? And is there an upper limit?
Well, I think a lot of people are going to put stop losses on it at 100K because that's been a sort of a benchmark for a time. I actually... I have been quite successful at projecting the Bitcoin price the last few years.
We'll listen to this now.
And this year I said, you know, 75K. And if two things, Trump plus the ability of the BlackRock and Fidelity ETF providers to stem the volatility, because that's another topic that maybe we have time to discuss. But I think those two are actually going to happen, and I'm reckoning on 100K.
Right.
Definitely,
you said
before
it.
Trump take, yeah, but definitely in January, but possibly in December. The thing is that a lot of the banks and asset managers who have recently moved into crypto have already made a lot of profits, so they may want to lock in their bonuses before the end of December. So maybe we won't see that 100K rally before the end of the year. But the way it's been going the last few days, it could actually happen. But anyway, my recent predictions were for in January that it would reach
Professor Carol Alexander, we're going to have to come back to you on that one, and then we'll maybe in December or January we can put that to you next time. We really appreciate your time. Also with us is George Conboy, Chairman of Brighton Securities. George, what do you think? Can this rally sustain?
I don't see why not, Leanna. I think that when you have any asset class, it can go up in value if it increases in popularity and acceptance. And we talk about currency or metals or stocks or bonds. They're widely accepted, and there's no increase in acceptance there. They're broadly accepted. Mm. Crypto is a completely different story. As more people say, gee, I don't have to carry a flash drive. I don't have to keep a long string of numbers. As we securitize crypto and make it more liquid, more and more people will be attracted. That can drive a rally.
Mm. Now, Bitcoin doing well, also US stocks, but European stocks not doing so well after Donald Trump's election win. Why might that be?
Well, part of it may be that Trump does tend to be somewhat nationalist. And the idea of, gee, we may put on a tariff, or we're going to ask you to pay for more of your own defense. Those things may be somewhat of a drag on European economies. That's part of it. The other part, let's face it, the U.S. market is the big game, and capital is coming here. Some of that capital may come out of European markets.
Mm. Home Depot had numbers out today. It's actually pointing to hurricanes boosting its business. I mean, what do you make of that?
Sure. Well, when your house gets wrecked or nearly wrecked, you've got to fix it up. Both Home Depot and their big competitor Lowe's are seeing more business from people who need plywood, paint, nails, but also more interest from investors who say, how can I profit from strange weather? So those two factors are driving that one.
Mm, another big story today is the fall of a Silicon Valley star, 23andMe, big drops in revenue, 40% cut of its workforce. What's that saying about the demand for personal genetics testing?
Yeah, Leanna, we're going to call that former Silicon Valley star, not present. Make sure we get our tens right here. Yeah, 5 years ago, that stock was $360, and today it's underneath $5. With the staff cut, it's very questionable about how much more demand there will be. CEO's been trying to take the company private for a while now. Very clouded outlook, but certainly a negative one there.
All right. Well, thanks so much for that analysis and that correction, George Conboy, Chairman of Brighton Securities. I'll speak to you soon. Your World Business Report from the BBC World Service. Now, the latest COP summit has drawn attention to an important warning from the UN's World Meteorological Organization. 2024 is on track to be the warmest year ever recorded. This surge in global temperatures is fueling more frequent and severe weather events, from wildfires to flash floods, already impacting food and drink production worldwide. Daniel Rosny has been investigating how these changes are affecting the wine industry.
When you think about wine-producing countries, the UK may not spring to mind, but figures from industry association Wine GB show that there are now more than 1,000 vineyards which produced more than 21 million bottles last year. That was up almost 80% from the year before, but that growth isn't guaranteed to continue.
It's not been a great year.
Nick Wayman owns Albury Vineyard in Surrey, England.
We've had a pretty poor summer. Lots and lots of rain, which has caused some disease on the vineyard.
The harvest was later than other years for Nick and his team, and there's no guarantee the grapes are good enough to be used for wine.
We've had as much as 38 tonnes in 2018 and as little as 3 tonnes in 2021, when we were completely overtaken with downy mildew. I think the general sort of view is that we're going to get more good years going forward, but we're going to get more bad years as well.
With extreme weather as a result of climate change becoming more unpredictable, it's getting harder for businesses to weather the storm. Now the industry is coming together globally to learn how to adapt. Catherine Le Parmentier is Managing Director of Great Wine Capitals.
In Bordeaux in particular, it's been a tough year. We've had frozen in May, which is terrible because all the flowers are already out. So when it freezes, it's really bad. Then we had hail episodes early summer when the grapes now are out.
Catherine set up Great Wine Capitals 25 years ago. It's a global network of wine regions from countries like Argentina, South Africa, the US and New Zealand.
One of the very important thing that we share in terms of crisis. Almost 3 years ago now, there were these bushfires destroying the whole South Australian vineyards and region, right? The fires were not even down that they connected with Napa. Napa Valley is also undergoing these huge fires.
But there's a growing need in the wine sector for preventative measures rather than a post-mortem. That's where global consultancy Vinescapes says it can help. Its founder is Alistair Nesbitt.
We go in and we help to try and build resilience into their businesses. Everything we do is driven really by sort of science, and for some businesses, it's much longer term. The change is happening so quick in terms of climate. Brands are having to adapt and they're having to become flexible.
But while the industry is looking for solutions, critics in traditional wine-growing parts of the world argue that red tape is preventing producers from making changes. Here's Amando Corsi, an associate professor of wine business in Adelaide.
We have been planting lately a lot more of, for example, Italian grape varieties. Because of their adaptability to the Australian climate, unlike Europe, where if you are linked with a specific protected designation of origin, a specific code of production, there is no way that you can plant whatever you want.
On the Greek island of Santorini, in a region long known for its wines, some estimates suggest grape production is less than half of what it was 20 years ago.
My name is Yanis Valambos, and I'm the founder of Vasaltis Vineyards.
Since 2019, it became apparent that we have to kind of evolve our cultivation techniques. Here, we're not talking about irrigation that will increase the yields. We're talking about irrigation that will help the plant survive.
And hopefully for the business to survive too. A report in the Nature Reviews Earth and Environment Journal suggests around 70% of wine regions could be lost if the planet warms to 2 degrees above pre-industrial levels. So projections that temperatures will hit a 1.5 degrees Celsius rise in 2024 could be hard for winemakers to swallow.
That was Daniel Rosny reporting, and you can hear more by searching for Business Daily wherever you get your BBC podcasts. All right, let's talk about the brand that goes hand in hand with British luxury and prestige, Jaguar. It's known for its sleek sports cars and royal connections, but now you won't be able to buy any of its cars new in the UK until 2026. Why? Well, the company has announced a plan to relaunch as an all-electric brand. Dealerships will only offer pre-owned models until new EVs hit the market. I asked David Bailey, car expert and professor of business economics at the Birmingham Business School, what's driving this drastic move?
So Jaguar is being reinvented as a brand. It's shifting from the kind of the premium market to the luxury end of things and going all electric. But those electric cars are not ready yet. So JLR have taken the decision to finish off production of internal combustion engine Jaguars early, in fact, and there's going to be a pause until the electric luxury vehicles arrive. So yes, it's a bold move. There'll be a gap in production, and also they're repositioning the brand to really take on the likes of Bentley.
The timing is interesting, though, isn't it? Many manufacturers are saying there's a plateau in EV demand. So why is Jaguar committing to this strategy now?
Jaguar is quite a small brand, so it's part of JLR, but it can't cover all of the bases in terms of petrol, diesel, electric, and the company's had to really focus on one of them. Long term, this is the right direction of travel. There does seem to be issues in the short term about the rollout of infrastructure and getting private people to go electric, but long term, they're basically taking a bet. I think one of the big issues is that this luxury sector is not a sector it's competed in previously, and so it's going to have to really enter a completely new market.
But it's a bet, right? What could success or failure, what could that mean for the brand?
I think it's probably the kind of last chance saloon for the brand. It hasn't been doing that well in recent years, despite making very good cars. But it was in probably the toughest segment of the market, which was the premium sector. And it never really cut it against the likes of BMW, really because of its kind of reliability. So what they're trying to do is think, well, OK, let's start again. Let's hark back to the kind of the glory days of the E-Type and the XJ from years ago. And let's try and reposition the brand.
Considering the recent US election and its implications on trade policies, particularly for EV regulations, do you see any significant challenges Jaguar might face launching this electric lineup in that market?
Well, two big challenges. One is that Trump may decide to impose 10% tariffs on all imports of cars, including from the UK. So that will affect Jaguar in one of its biggest markets, the United States. Secondly, there's a big question as to whether Trump will backtrack on the Environmental Protection Agency targets of really ramping up electric vehicle sales through to 2030, 2032. And if he backtracks on that, the market won't expand as quickly. So a couple of really big political kind of curveballs being thrown into Jaguar in that sense.
Could it also hurt the customer base too? And surely it's going to have repercussions for Jaguar's dealerships and brand loyalty.
Yes, very much so. So particularly as the company isn't selling new cars in the UK over the next year, you know, that's going to be a struggle for dealers. They'll be selling kind of pre-registered and second-hand Jaguars, but they're going to have to really be looking forwards and trying to think about how they can attract customers for the next big thing, which is going to be these luxury EVs. Having said all of that, it may be a completely different audience because previously these were premium car buyers. They're now trying to sell into a much more international luxury market.
I think you might have mentioned Bentley, and, you know, its pivot is kind of similar to that, isn't it? Are there lessons or warnings that they might draw from that example?
I think the lesson I would take is that it's a long-term game. So if you're trying to move into a new market segment, you know, it may not happen overnight. You're probably going to have to plug away at it for a long time. And so essentially, whilst, you know, Jaguar has a heritage and a brand to draw on, it's going to take time to really, I think, compete against the likes of Bentley or possibly even Rolls-Royce.
That was David Bailey, car expert and professor of business economics at the Birmingham Business School. And that's it from the World Business Report team. Our producers today are Matt Lyons and Victoria Holland. Chloe Wilson was on the tech. James Wickham is our editor. And I'm Leanna Byrne. Don't forget, a podcast of World Business Report is always available wherever you get your podcasts.